Dr. Ryan Stanton here with ASEP Frontline, here on day three of ASEP 16 in Las Vegas, Nevada, talking with Dr. Ryan Sin, Critical Care Medicine Section, Department of Critical Care Medicine and Emergency Medicine, Mayo Clinic, Arizona. And you're a great person to talk to because I think over the last few years we have seen a very significant breakdown of the walls that once separated emergency medicine and critical care medicine. It's very much now a continuum. And so I think it's something very important for us to understand that, one, much of the critical care is in the emergency department, but also we want to figure out how to seamlessly transition that to the intensive care units within our hospital. So give us a little background on yourself and where you're seeing critical care and emergency interacting now.
Sure. Thank you, Ryan, for inviting me to the ASEP Frontline. It's an absolute honor and delight to be here talking to the ASEP members. A little bit about myself. I did my emergency medicine residency at the Henry Ford Hospital in Detroit, in Michigan, and subsequently critical care fellowship at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center. I have been on staff at the Mayo Clinic College of Medicine. I'm based out of Arizona, Scottsdale, Arizona, the warm and fuzzy Mayo, as we call it. And I'm appointed by the Department of Critical Care Medicine, as well as faculty for Department of Emergency Medicine as well. Great points that you raised. I think the section was formed a couple of decades ago pertaining to promoting the clinical excellence in areas of critical care practice in the emergency department. And in due course of time, over the last decade or so, people got, you know, interested in certifying in critical care. In fact, the interest was always there, mm-hmm. but the challenge was board certification. And as you may know, in the last several years, last 3 or 4 years, we have managed to bridge those barriers. A lot of emergency physicians have been able to attain board certification through internal medicine, anesthesia, and general surgery, critical care tracks as well. So we are a very growing number of dual board certified emergency intensivists. Our section membership is currently at 885. It does include members who are also primarily emergency medicine trained because we've always felt that we are one big house. And as you mentioned, a lot of critical care resuscitation takes place in the EDs. In many centers, in academic and community centers. And I think the advantages, we're not only catering to the professional needs of dual board certified EM ICU physicians, but as you mentioned, to improve the practice of critical care in the EDs. And, as it's a constant, it should be a seamless process. Until now, there have been a lot of issues related to boarding in the ED, especially with critical care patients. And we want to ensure that we enhance our practice. We bring upstairs care downstairs, as we say, while taking care of issues like boarding and trying to prevent issues with patient throughput. We are able to collaborate with ICUs, talk to the intensivists who are from medical backgrounds, surgical backgrounds, so we are helpful in liaising between these two groups that until now have somewhat practiced siloed care in many places. And so we are at the forefront of, in some ways, uniting the different streams of critical care resuscitation from the ED to the ICU. And there's a lot of work to be done, but we are very excited as our membership grows. We want, in fact, every emergency physician to have the opportunity to take membership of our section, the educational offerings that we have, and stuff that we do in our section in particular.
More and more of that critical care that presents to the emergency department is the expectations, whether it's through guidelines or requirements or metrics, are being placed on the emergency department. I'm very fortunate. I live in a place where I can contact our intensivist very early, and they're happy to come down. And many times those significant first stages of care are taking place in our departments, where in the past it was, we would initially, as soon as we got a diagnosis or confirmation they were getting admitted, make that call, and it was very separated. But it's now it's very much more a team. So I want to talk about the one, if you're at a place that does have a very active ICU or critical care services versus the community doctor, whereas 80 to 90% of our membership works in community medicine, and they may not have a very active, so the emergency physician may be the most trained at critical care, even if not boarded in critical care. Right. So let's separate it out. How do we start with the community physician?
Right.
How do we, one, make sure that we are ready for it, and then two, working with or teaming up with someplace that you know you can make that transition of care to critical care?
Absolutely. Great points. And you're absolutely right. A lot of care is provided in the emergency department. And in fact, as we all know, the golden hour and the platinum minutes of care take place for the pre-hospital and the first hour or two of ED care. And we may provide the best fanciful technology in the ICUs, but if we do not provide great emergency care, then a lot of things may not progress in the direction that we want to. I think the advantage that community physicians can gain out of being a part of the section of critical care medicine, as well as coming to our sessions, educational sessions and all, is knowing, you know, what is expected in the realms of critical care practice, from the world of trauma to neurosciences to cardiovascular emergencies. There's already a lot of knowledge and insight within the primary ASEP membership and practicing emergency physicians, but at the same time, having the perspective of what happens in the ICU, the long-term care aspects of it, I think it would be extremely beneficial, because sometimes those community physicians and all may be required to take care of those patients for the 8, 12 hours and 24 hours at times. I hear some patients actually board in the ED for a lot longer. And so knowing some of the intricacies of the long-term care aspect of things is so critical, because we're very good at that first 1 or 2 hours, and then what else do we need to do as other patients are flowing in into the ED? A concept that's actually been talked about in our world of ED critical care is ED ICUs. And Scott Weingart, who's obviously very well known to the world of emergency medicine, introduced the idea. He's been running an ED ICU in Stony Brook in New York. Kyle Gunnarsson in Michigan has initiated that system as well. So people can be actually monitored and resuscitated in an ICU within the emergency department run by emergency physicians as well. So there are a lot of interesting work that's ongoing at this time for equipping the community ED docs who can learn from these models and also learn the long-term care aspect of things. What would the cardiac surgeon like if it's a cardiovascular CT surgery patient versus the neurosurgeon who's dealing with an intracranial hemorrhage? What are the expectations if they cannot go to the OR right away? What are the management issues that they need to know about in terms of maybe hyperosmolar therapy, ICP reducing strategies, and the first 24-hour of care, if I may.
And if you are a community physician and you say, I don't necessarily need to know critical care because I'm in a small hospital, I've worked in small hospitals before, I think the pressure is even higher because your staff isn't accustomed to see. I remember at a hospital where I placed the first deep line and did the first intubation that they had seen in years.
Right.
And so in those cases, you are going to be the expert. Yeah. I mean, if you're working at a great academic center, you've got your staff is accustomed to it. Everybody's accustomed to it. You have backup. But I think knowing critical care, building relationships with hospitals that you can transfer to or consult with is even more important, because that critical patient may be rare, but they're still critical when they show up at your emergency department. Now, say I'm working in like my facility I'm in now. It's not an academic center overall, but it is very active in critical care, a lot of MIs, strokes, a little bit of trauma, a lot of sepsis and things like that. How do we tear down that wall between the ICU and the emergency department if you've got two very strong departments within your hospital?
Yeah, great points. And I think the biggest aspect is having opportunities to collaborate between the two departments, and primarily the best way is to kind of have shared learning experiences, quality improvement aspects that can also help the two departments to liaise together. For example, we have joined educational sessions between the ED and ICU in our hospital, and we look at all the codes that took place in the ED and the ICU as well to review what were the opportunities for improvement. I know of similar metrics that other hospitals have looked at, where people break ice, get to know each other. They know what their expectations are, because we cannot work in silos at all, especially in places that have two very strong units. And then having people who are dual boarded in both areas is also a great advantage, because they can work as the liaison between learning about the challenges that pure emergency physicians work in the ED phase versus the medical intensivists or the surgeons, who may not actually know some of the intricacies of the problems as we encounter in triage and systems and throughput, which we're probably very good at managing. We just have to work together to ensure that folks appreciate individual perspectives as pertaining to ICU versus the ED. So education, quality improvement, and even research projects can be potentially helpful because we want to advance the science as well of the interface between ED and ICU. We want to know how can we provide the better care. Maybe it's handoff. How can we do the handoff better? What are the challenges when it comes to improving surge capacity when we have too many patients in the ED? Can the ICU similarly help in moving patients through and discharging them to tele or med-surg, intermediate force? Can those systems be incorporated? For that, it requires a lot of respect for what we all stand for, and I think engaging intensivists in smaller and hospitals that don't have ED intensivists necessarily is a very important role that we all need to play.
Relationships are huge. And I think that's why we are successful where I practice, because we have great relationships. We have great friendships. They invite us to call with questions.
Yeah.
We always are involved. In fact, the care isn't ER, ICU with a defined line in between. We work together from very early on to help take care of the patient, understanding that the patient's care isn't siloed. Patient's care is a continuum, and if we're going to improve outcomes, we need to make sure that is consistent. And wrapping up the community hospital side of things, I think you need to take an inventory of your hospital and your emergency department. What are our strengths? What are our weaknesses? What are our resources? And then what's it going to take? Because practicing in New York City is very different than practicing in rural Montana,
right,
where you may be several hours from a tertiary care center.
Right.
And so I think you need to be able to take that take note of what you have and what you need to do to make sure that you have that process in place for your patients. Because I think that's a lot of times a lot of education comes from academic centers that have all kinds of resources.
Right.
And so I think you, in many ways, will turn off the very small hospital, the doc that's still out there working 48-hour shifts,
yeah,
because it's slow enough that you can get some sleep in between. Now, one of the big things, I've got the IMRA antibiotic guide sitting here right in front of me from one earlier. And a big thing we're dealing with here, and it seems like the juggling balls and maybe turning into a couple chainsaws, is the care of the sepsis patient.
Right.
And it seems to be a moving target. It has been a moving target for the last couple of years now. Right. As soon as we get guidelines, it comes out that the guidelines may not be accurate. We're finding new research. Where the research is now is not where the guidelines are necessary. Talk to me some about sepsis and how we improve the outcomes for our patients from a critical care standpoint.
Yeah, I'm glad you asked the question, because I think all the membership of the critical care section are very passionate about the area of sepsis and the emergency medicine world too. And I think, I trained in the place with Manny Rivers and all where the first goal-directed therapy study was done, and it changed the paradigm of care in the way we manage septic patients in the ED. So ED was in the front line of improving quality of care in the septic patients, and then the other units and hospitals started adopting some of those paradigms and guidelines. Obviously, in the last several years, there have been new studies, and we are looking at the evidence closely. I think, with some of the challenges, and you know about the CMS directives and all that, there's a lot of frustration expressed by emergency physicians. I think the most important thing is we should probably be careful not to channel our frustrations into, plain opposition. We need to come together. Once again, the House of Medicine needs to come together and figure out what is the evidence? We know what the evidence is right now, but how does it pertain to individual areas? Whether it's the patient on the floor and the EDs, and do the guidelines really apply in patients, in unselected patient population? And what can we do to improve the expectations? Because obviously the CMS guidelines and are based on current research. But I think this is an opportunity for all of us in the House of Emergency Medicine and Critical Care to come together and say, can we apply those in patients, at every instance? and improve the quality of care based on the research that needs to be done, because I don't think we are done with the research yet.
No, sure.
And at the same time, quality improvement, look at individual centers, because a lot of things are institutional, as you rightly mentioned. How do the community hospitals deal with a septic patient, the ED? Maybe very different from academic centers. So yes, we want to have some, in some ways, one size fit all in terms of the guidelines, but they need to be tailored to individual institutional challenges. For example, in a busy small community ED, maybe the ED physician may not be able to put in a central line if the patient needs vasopressors and all. But what can be done from a quality management paradigm? Do they need a PIC team, you know, some extra resources that can help patients get vasopressors without using a peripheral line if they go on higher dose of vasopressors? Or can the resources be modified for an academic center that they come to the ICU if their bed's available? Like, we don't usually have an ICU bed problem where I work, rather than the patient lying in the ED for several hours. So I think a lot of the systems and, quality issues are pertaining to individual sites and not necessarily a one-size-fits-all under these circumstances. But doing more research, doing more quality improvement projects is where we need to come together and figure out what's the best approach towards sepsis. And I think there are a lot of initiatives through ASEP that we're looking at the data now, several projects that will be trying to capture the data from of patients who come to the ED diagnosed of sepsis through their continuum of stay into the to the floors in ICUs and come up with guidelines for the critical care societies as well. So I think this world is going to change the next few years because we're learning from each other. But the thing that I'm going to stress upon is we don't need to break down the barriers. We've managed to come close together with all the other departments in the hospital. It is time that we unite the world of and House of Medicine in sepsis care.
Sepsis is one of those where it seems like the guidelines when they came out were a bit of a Band-Aid too large for the wound we were taking care of. And as soon as they came out, and that's the challenge with guidelines, is, of course, like anything else, whether it's textbooks or whether it's teaching courses or whatever it is, are going to lag the most modern research. And so your 30 cc per kilogram bolus, that's fantastic, unless they're not volume responsive, somebody who has a significant issue associated with the fluid already. Treating SIRS criteria with your broad spectrum antibiotics when every patient with flu has meets SIRS criteria.
Right.
You know, I think it's one of those things where we need to take the guidelines and figure out how to, as the House of Medicine, critical care, emergency medicine, infectious disease, how to apply those and say, listen, this is not a cookbook. We're not cooking the same loaf of bread every time we put it in the oven. It's a little bit different. And knowing how to apply that, and that I think that's where that you still have that critical thinking as a physician and professional. Right. Guidelines are great.
Yeah.
Guidelines are a guidance.
Right.
But they are not they're not the Bible of medicine.
Right. And I completely agree, and which is why I said, you know, when folks talk together, then they'll realize a lot of it is based on good clinical medicine at the bedside. We've had situations where I've taken a patient when I was in the ICU in the last month, who was diagnosed of sepsis, hypotensive patient, got 3 liters of fluid. Turns out that he has a large PE with obstructive shock.
Mm-hmm.
And that patient goes into RV failure because my ED colleagues followed the 30 cc per kg protocol to an extent. By the time they got an echo, they had a good idea that the RV was in trouble. So I think you cannot apply guidelines blindly. They're not protocols.
Right.
There's
Absolutely.
A huge difference between them. And so, we look at in our hospital, for example, the variances in sepsis care. When we assign, reviewers, we actually look at, did those patients meet sepsis criteria in the ED? Were they diagnosed of sepsis? And if so, were the treatment paradigms that were followed appropriate? And if not, why were they not appropriate? And if we find that their cardiac function was poor and the physician documented that or there were data related to that, that makes the job very easy. Because, as you know, right now it's a lot about documentation as well.
Yeah. Everything's documentation.
Yeah, so if we ask our colleagues or ourselves in the ICU as well to say, why did we not give 30 cc per kg fluid? Because we don't believe that this patient would have benefited and there would have been harm associated with that.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to have an open mind and treat the guidelines as they are, not take away from good clinical medicine At the same time, based on these guidelines, we should be documenting why are we doing what we're doing, and then provide feedback to the institutional bodies that are mandating us to do so and so, because that would help them know that we are actually following what the mandate is, but we're developing research to suggest that those are great for the septic patient in isolation, but for unselected patient population who meets those criteria and all, maybe they're not all applicable, and use good bedside judgment, use an echo or use bedside ultrasound and other paradigms of monitoring to make that judgment call, to say why we still did the right care for the patient, and not focus on the metrics only as we were expected to follow. So I think that is where our biggest aim is, to try and review those cases, provide feedback to the institutional bodies that are expecting us to follow some of those guidelines, and let them know that good clinical practice supplants every other guideline that's out there in the world. And if something bad happens, then for sure that's the feedback that needs to go to the physician, that you missed some of those criteria. The lactate clearance wasn't really followed. Some of those things can be very automated. We have a EMR system that actually has lactate draws every 3 hours.
Yeah, ours reflexes as well.
Yeah. And so, that's what I feel like. There's a lot of work to do in this domain as well.
I have to remind my ER staff that about 90% of our patients meet CSRS criteria, right, having to walk from the parking garage in the summer.
Right.
You know, they're tachypneic, they're tachycardic,
right,
they're diaphoretic. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're there for an ankle sprain. I'm not hitting them with Zosyn for an ankle sprain. And so, I mean, you still have to use that critical thinking. And also, we need to, as physicians, this is an evolving topic. Sepsis is not set. So you need to make sure that you're staying up to date with the information that's out there, the FOMED, other podcasts. You mentioned Scott Weingart. He does a fantastic job talking about this. He's done many on sepsis care, use of ultrasound, and tests you can do, whether it's a passive leg raise,
that.
So there's a lot of great sources out there, and I encourage you to make sure that you stay as an active learner, because it is. And nothing's going to be perfect.
Correct.
You know, 50% of medicine we practice today is going to be obsolete in 50 years.
Absolutely.
They're going to say it was malpractice.
Yeah.
But understanding that we need to practice based on that best information possible.
Yeah, and in addition, I would say what we always miss in the practice of medicine, emergency medicine in particular, is the pretest probability. Because when we send a troponin, we need to know what were the symptoms that made us draw that lab. In this day and age, because we can order a test without actually batting an eyelid.
Yeah, troponins, because you walked in the door.
Exactly. You walk in the door, you have a troponin.
Yeah, EKG, troponin, boom, you're done.
Right. And lactate is a problem now, because we people are putting in lactate for every patient that comes through. But what we're trying to educate as emergency physicians and critical care physicians as well, that, you need to have what's the pretest probability for you to order those tests? Did they meet the criteria? Only then would the lab test be of finite value, because it will provide you with the specificity of positive predictive value and things like that in terms of diagnosis of sepsis. Your ankle sprain patient, yes, you have CSRS criteria, but you don't have pretest probability of worrying about sepsis for that patient, because the problem is somewhere else. And so sometimes the education and the thought process that we are sort of inculcating in our newer generation of physicians and all, is all about meeting some, Boolean logic, and or if not, but they don't let us think about what's the primary etiology, what's the clinical signs and symptoms, and how do you approach diagnostic decision-making based on that.
Fantastic information, Dr. Ayan Sin. Am I saying it right?
Yeah, you're saying it absolutely right.
I mean, I've been here for 3 days. I'm Southern, so I say things weird anyway. And I want to make sure that I've got it right. Critical care medicine section here at the American College of Emergency Physicians, the warm version of Mayo Clinic down there in Arizona, so probably not a whole lot of parkas and snow boots and in your closet down there. Give us some idea how to contact you, whether either by social media, email, if folks have more information.
Sure, absolutely. I'm happy to speak to anybody at ASEP. My email address is sen.ayan@mayo.edu. That's sen.ayan@mayo.edu. And I'm available. I have a Facebook profile if people want to add. I have a Twitter profile, #ayan2024. And happy to collaborate with a lot of emergency physicians who are involved in the care of critical care patients. I think we are the best resuscitationists out there in the field, and we want to bring the House of Medicine together, but show that we do a fantastic job in the EDs. We'll be at the vanguard of improving the quality of care that we provide to any patient who walks into the doors with any critical illness.
Fantastic information. As for me, you can check us out, ASEP Frontline on Facebook. We have a page, like us, that can keep you up to date on the weekly releases of the podcast. as well as at Everyday Med on Twitter. And you can contact me at youreverydaymedicine@gmail.com, youreverydaymedicine@gmail.com. Reminder that ASAP Frontline is available on iTunes, so we want you to subscribe to the podcast so you can stay up to date. We're going to do our best to bring you the most up-to-date and cutting-edge in emergency medicine information. Thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
And as for me, I'm Dr. Ryan Stanton, and you've been listening to ASAP Frontline.